Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW and heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, Senator Orrin Hatch asks the media to go easy on Donald Trump. Also, Utah Republican leaders aren't exactly endorsing their party's presidential nominee, but they still want their members to get out and vote. A student at a Catholic high school pushes unsuccessfully for a gay-straight alliance club, and Utah's Commission on Public Lands is asked to account for the money it has spent as the state gears up for a lawsuit to try to take control of federal public lands within its borders. Those and other stories on the docket today, and I'm joined in the studio by Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Robert Gerke. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Also, justice and safety reporter Jennifer Dobner is here in studio. Jennifer, thanks as well.
Thank you.
Government and politics editor Dan Harry is here. Dan, good morning.
Good morning, Roger.
And joining us via the phone is Tribune Washington correspondent Thomas Burr. Tommy, good morning to you as well.
Good morning.
And listeners, you are encouraged to participate in this discussion. Tweet your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk or put them in the comments section at sltrib.com. Or you can call us up at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Well, a lot of politics on the show today. It's been that kind of a week. Thomas Burr, there in Washington, you reported earlier this week on an exchange that Senator Orrin Hatch had with reporters about who else? Donald Trump. Maybe it was a kind of joking exchange, but what was the advice that Hatch was offering up to the media?
First of all, I think it's going to be that kind of 5 months for the record. So it's going to continue all the way. As usual, and I think this is going to happen for the next while, several reporters grabbed Senator Hatch and a bunch of other senators outside the Senate during a vote this week, asking them what they think of, you know, the latest Donald Trump thing. In this case, it was Donald Trump's comments about the judge in the Trump University case in California being of Mexican heritage and whether that, you know, means he's biased against Trump. And Hatch was asked about it. He did call the comments inappropriate. He thought they were wrong. And he said that, you know, that Trump should be more careful what he says. It's not, there's a more formal way to criticize a judicial decision. But then he went a little further and he said, be nice to him. He's a first time candidate. Be nice to him. And noted that anyone in politics is going to make mistakes and the media is going to seize on them when they make you stupid blunders. It was an interesting, I don't know if you want to call it a defense or not, but Hatch is saying, you know, hey, he's new to politics. You should, you know, give him a little bit of slack.
All right. Well, a rookie and asking for some kid gloves for the rookie. You know, on the his comments on this judge, Hatch, you know, you said that they were inappropriate. Representative Jason Chaffetz had a more critical assessment of what Trump had to say. What was it that Chaffetz said about these statements?
Yeah, he was very clear that he totally disagreed with, you know, questioning the judge. You know, there's other ways to say, you know, disagree with something that you don't go after somebody's heritage like that. Still, of course, as with most other GOP people who are somewhat supporting, endorsing, at least saying they'll vote for Donald Trump, you know, Chaffetz is saying he's still better than Hillary. So it's okay. You know, he may make some really bad comments, but he's still better than Hillary, which I think is going to be a very constant refrain this cycle as from the Republican Party are stuck with this situation where they know that Donald Trump's going to say something that they, you know, completely abhor, but they, you know, still want people to vote for him. So they have to walk this very fine line.
Is that, I mean, that's not necessarily an endorsement. I think that Trump seems to inspire differences of opinion within his own party, and more so as we get closer to the party conventions, to the general election. Dan, Harry, or Tommy, either of you, maybe we can get a rundown of the Utah politicians who have either endorsed Trump or who have made statements along the lines of he's better than Hillary, and where are others coming down on his candidacy? Because there's not a lot of consensus here.
I'll try and take this one. I think Mike Lee and Mia Love are the only two of our delegation who haven't said that they would vote for the Republican nominee. My favorite, of course, always that I've got to mention is Representative Chris Stewart, who called Trump our Mussolini and then said he would vote for the Republican nominee later.
Locally as well, you've got Governor Herbert, who said he hopes to meet with Donald Trump before the Republican convention and get to know him a little better.
He wants to do a personal vetting.
So he was a little bit on the fence, I guess. You've got Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, however, who's pretty adamant that he's a never Trump guy, and he's I think they're going to be looking around for somebody else. And then, you know, in the Senate, in the state Senate, you've got some people like Senator Mark Madsen, who spoke recently at the Libertarian Convention. You know, he's a Republican delegate. But I think there's a lot of reluctance there from some members of Utah politicos in terms of supporting him.
Well,
and if I can add in real fast,
of course,
on that never Trump thing, the interesting part about the Libertarian side is Gary Johnson is now the Libertarian Party's presidential candidate, and his campaign is being run out of Utah, actually.
Well, and that's led to some speculating that that Utah could perhaps see a split vote, and that Hillary has an actual chance of winning. Is that an assessment that you think is, you know, plausible, Tommy?
We'll have to see. You know, I think there's some people who are, you know, not, they don't want to vote for Trump. They certainly don't want to vote for Hillary, but then they don't want to vote for, you know, a guy who talks about smoking pot either. So, you know, really not, for some people, there's not a great choice at all.
Well, and keep in mind, Bill Clinton, when he ran, came in third in the state with a third party candidate, Ross Perot, who finished second that year. And so, you know, even though there's not a lot of love for Trump, I think there's some animosity for the Clintons generally, although it is interesting that now the third party candidate maybe gives her a chance to actually win the state rather than, you know, we're talking about the Clinton finishing third this time.
Robert Gerke, to address the fears that Republican voters in Utah might be kind of turned off by a Trump candidacy, Republican Party Chairman James Evans talked about a new strategy that he wants to implement. This is something that Lee Davidson reported on, but Robert, can either you or maybe Dan talk about the Utah GOP's Plan T?
Plan T is the name that James Evans came up with, and Coily wouldn't say whether it standard for Trump, but certainly it does. And what it is essentially, look, we want you to get out to vote. We don't care if you don't like Donald Trump and you don't vote for Donald Trump. You can vote for anyone you like to. You can write in Mickey Mouse, but please go out and vote if you're a Republican, because we have a lot of candidates down ticket that need your vote. And what this reflects is a fear of James Evans in particular, who's, by the way, no big fan of Donald Trump, the fear that Republicans will just stay home. They won't vote for Hillary. They won't vote for Gary Johnson. They won't vote for Donald Trump. So they figure, the presidential year I usually vote, but this year I'm going to stay home to register my disapproval. Or disgust. And that's what they're really afraid of, because if that happens, you have some races where that could make a huge difference. And I think primarily their fear is the Salt Lake County Council, mm-hmm. where Republicans control the majority by one vote. And there are also some, the 4th Congressional District with Doug Owens, Mia Love, which was pretty close last time. And then there are about 3 legislative seats in Salt Lake County that last election were so close that it looked like the Democrats won on election night. And then by the canvas 2 weeks later, when they'd counted all the absentee ballots, the Republicans had squeaked by and won. So those are the things that they're really afraid of at the margins, that if a lot of Republicans stayed home, that's where it would cost them.
Well, and it's kind of interesting, because I think it's not just Trump, because you have, you know, people who are going to be disillusioned with Trump. Sure, that's part of it. You also, the next ticket on the race is the gubernatorial race, typically not a close contest in Utah, so your vote doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot there. 3 of the 4 congressional races are typically not going to be close. At least 2 of them are likely to not be very close. And so you end up with this dynamic where if you live in one of those congressional districts, you really don't have a race at the top of the ticket to get you out to vote. And so what the Republicans are trying to do is make sure that they motivate people, give them something else that they feel like they can vote for and make a difference on, that motivates them to get out to the polls.
An effort to get out the vote, even if it isn't for Mr. T. I know that we're devoting actually a lot of time to all things Trump here, and we will move on to other topics eventually, I promise. But There is, we're not quite there yet, because yesterday the Washington Post floated a Utah's name as a potential Trump vice president. Dan Harry, as if I even need to ask this question, who are we talking about?
Mia Love. And I think it was kind of, well, it was clickbait, really, was the Washington Post. It was kind of showed all these faces, and it said, you decide who you think will be the selection. And, you know, it's just one of those things that gets people talking. What are the buzz? Who are the insiders? Who are the people that have kind of a check the box, this would help the ticket or not? And she ended up on that list. And she, you know, she hasn't endorsed Trump. And she quickly said, you know, dismissed it as, like, I'm not in contact with the Trump campaign, you know, and made it sound like even if asked, she wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. So,
well, we just talked about James Evans being worried about, you know, down ballot races. The 4th congressional district is obviously one of them. And this is getting way ahead of the game. But, you know, a Trump love ticket would leave Evans and the Utah GOP scrambling for a candidate in that race. I guess that's the case for anybody who's facing re-election around the country who might be being considered for a VP.
Right. That's really the case. The Trump factor is a huge one in consideration of people who have endorsed him. Now, some are backing away. Others, like Orrin Hatch, are kind of defending the comments that he makes. You know, and can they do that for the next several months? That's a tough thing to do. You know, you can do it once or twice, maybe. It doesn't make you look great, like you have great judgment. But, you know, after a couple of times, I don't think you can keep doing that. So if Trump continues the rhetoric that he has been spewing up to this point, those folks, I think, are a little afraid of how they're going to handle that down the road.
Thomas Byrd,
can I jump in here?
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
I was going to add my favorite part about everyone, the speculation about who Trump's going to pick as his vice presidential candidate. I mean, we all know the answer to this. He's going to pick himself, because who would be better than Donald Trump to be the vice president of the
United States? It's going to be a great vice president.
The greatest.
Thomas, I got to ask, is Mia Love a real contender in this potential scenario? I mean, could she be a VP candidate?
No. I mean, I think there's no question that she doesn't want to tie herself to that ticket. She doesn't want to jump from being, you know, a one-term House member to, you know, this race. She's got to focus on her own race. Now, the question of who he actually is really going to pick, man, that's pretty open-ended, because, you know, there's not a lot of people who really he really needs that would really want to be running with him.
Okay. Oddsmakers having fun trying to determine who is going to jump in on this.
One thing
I vote Robert Gerke personally.
One thing I thought was really interesting in Mia Love's response was she went off on Hillary Clinton and the whole notion of a, you know, a historic landmark for being the first woman to win a major party's nomination. We had reached out to her the day before and asked her for a reaction because we were rounding up a reaction from Utah women. And, you know, Republicans and Democrats alike were pretty much, you know, I may not like Hillary personally or her politics, but this is a great day for women. And, you know, when I was a girl growing up and looked at these races, I thought, never in my lifetime will I see a woman not only win the presidency, but win the nomination of a major party, which has been, you know, a boys' club throughout American history. And so this changes that, but...
97 years since women had the right to vote.
But Mia Love just bashed Hillary Clinton and said, this is not, you know, a historic landmark. This is a historic disaster.
Right.
And it was just a very shrill rhetoric that she used that was kind of surprising because, you know, when she ran, it was on this notion that she was making history.
Well, and she also voted for Barack Obama because she felt like it was important to have a black nominee. And so it's a totally different ballgame.
It's a very strange twist there.
You know, it's part of politics, I imagine, people trying to walk a fine line in a world where this is about winning races. You know, I mean, this is what it comes down to. Guys, we are going to have to take a quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. Listeners, join our conversation by tweeting your comments to the hashtag TribTalk, posting them at sltrib.com, or calling us at 801-355-TALK to join the conversation. Coming up, Senator Hatch Research says the media should go easy on Trump, but Trump is not going easy on reporters. We'll hear more about that in a moment after this short break.
The ancient Celtic year followed four seasons, each one launched by a festival. Celebrated with bonfires, Beltane marks the coming of summer, the fertility of the season, the greening of the earth. Feel the warmth in the music this week on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Join us tonight at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. California's beaches are being washed away by erosion, made worse by climate change and El Nino.
The problem is in California, we've developed right up to our beaches, and so we sort of don't have a natural buffer anymore that would protect us from sources like sea level rise. And going forward, we need to start planning and taking that into account.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Join us this morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, joined this hour by various Salt Lake Tribune staffers, reporters Robert Gerke, Thomas Burr, and Jennifer Dobner, and editor Dan Harry. And we're looking at this past week's news and review. Again, you are invited to join this conversation. Call us at 801-355-TALK, post a comment at sltrib.com, or tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. So I swore that we would move past Trump and on to other topics, and we will momentarily, but I first want to get to back to Senator Hatch's request that the media treat Donald Trump with kid gloves. It's an interesting request, especially given the fact that Trump hasn't exactly been holding back in his, attacks on journalists. Tommy, this is a story that you participated in rather than reported on. In addition to being the Salt Lake Tribune's Washington correspondent, you're also president of the National Press Club, and you issued a statement rebuking some comments that Trump made about reporters. What were those comments, and maybe you can give us the context here as well.
You know, it's actually a very odd spot to be in so many ways, because the National Press Club often speaks out about press freedom issues in China, Eritrea, and, you know, Egypt and Turkey and those kind of situations where they, you know, deride the press all the time. In this situation, this is actually the third time we've said something about Donald Trump, mainly just because of how he continues to not just disparage the press, but actually, you know, call for, plead for people to hate the press, calling reporters sleaze or calling them disgusting and by name, as well as, you know, doing things like blacklisting outlets that will not have access to his rallies anymore. He's banning people from BuzzFeed and Huffington Post and sometimes, you know, the Wall Street Journal or other organizations that are, widely respected. So in this case, Trump was going on and on about the bad media for questioning whether he'd actually given the, you know, $6 million to the veterans groups. And he really just, you know, kind of just went on a rant about the media. And the statement I put out was pretty much, you know, if you're running against the First Amendment, you're running in the wrong country, because this is what we're kind of based on, the idea that, you know, the citizens are able to question their leaders or prospective leaders. And it is incredibly disappointing. I want to be fair here, too. If, you know, Hillary Clinton were to say the same things, we'll absolutely speak out against that, too. It shouldn't be the case that politicians are railing against the media for actually doing their job. It's fine. Let us be, you know, look, we're scapegoats when it comes to, you know, you want to rally your troops. But it's still, that's what the reporters should be doing, is questioning, did Trump, as he promised, give millions of dollars to veterans groups? And he didn't until he was questioned about it.
Hmm. Well, I guess the point is that if you get into politics and you run for the highest office in the land, you're going to face some pretty serious scrutiny. That's part of the job of the press. You were one of various people who were calling out Trump for what he said about attacking the press for calling him, taking him to task for not having followed through with his contribution. Did Trump respond to your counter criticism of his attacks on the press, I guess?
You know, he didn't respond directly to me or the press club. I was kind of awaiting that. I kind of expected at least a tweet, maybe. Kind of feel left out for some reason. But I think, we'll continue to... I don't think we're going to change his mind anytime soon. You know, he's going to continue to use us as the foil in the campaign.
Well, one set of controversial comments from Trump, followed by another, and five more months of campaigning to go, everybody. Well, let's finally move on to some other topics from this past week's news, detouring away from politics for a little bit, though we will try to get back to the governor's race, public lands, the state's crusade against pornography before the hour is out. Right now, though, Justice reporter Jennifer Dobner, you reported on a student at a local Catholic high school who wants to form a gay-straight alliance at his school, but who is having some trouble. Tell us about Lewis Fisher.
It might be politics of another kind. Okay. But so Lewis is just finished his junior year at Judge. He's an openly gay student who felt like the campus environment was generally welcoming, but that there were a lot of kids who didn't quite feel like they had a safe space in which to talk about the experience of being gay in high school. And he said to me, you know, high school's bad enough without, you know, also being gay. And so he did what he was supposed to do. There's a, if you want to get a club, any club, you get a small petition, you get five signatures of support from other students, you see if you can find a faculty advisor, you go to the activities director. His club was sort of immediately rejected. He then sat down with the principal, and he was basically told to redirect his efforts to the Peace and Social Justice Club. They felt like that was an umbrella under which he could raise the issues that he wanted to raise, and as the principal said to me, provide some, you know, leadership in that area. Lewis thinks that that dilutes the message and that it doesn't accomplish what he wants to accomplish. I think from talking to the school, they do a lot of good things to try to promote safety. They're really concerned about bullying. They're concerned about inclusivity. But Lewis's position is that's a different conversation. It's part of the conversation, but it's not the whole conversation.
This is a kind of familiar discussion. I was a student at East High School in 1995 when the state legislature essentially blocked all non-curricular clubs to prevent a gay-straight alliance at East, and that led to protests and a lawsuit. This is a little bit different, though, Judge being a private Catholic school.
Right. They don't have to follow any sort of state laws. They also do not have to comply with the 1984 Equal Access Law that would require schools, public institutions, to provide equal access to all students to club activities. So he's really left with, Judge can make its own rules. They have to, of course, sort of work within the umbrella of Catholic teachings, because the Catholic Church doesn't, you know, condone homosexuality, and they don't, you know, they're not in the marriage equality fight either. But they, there are some GSAs at Catholic high schools around the country. There's one at Xavier High School, which is a Jesuit school. And actually, the alma mater of Scalia. There's one there. There's one in Iowa. There's one in Portland. There's one at Notre Dame, the university. So they are start, and there's a few in Toronto. And so it's starting to be something that's happening on Catholic campuses. But it's really up to the individual school. I tried to talk to the other Catholic high schools in Utah, St. Joe's in Ogden and Juan Diego down in Draper-Sandy area. Right. I also tried to talk to the Catholic Diocese's superintendent of schools with no return phone calls. My understanding is that St. Joe's in Ogden had a thing called the Crossroads Club for a while. It was actually started at the same time that the principal who's now a judge was the principal at St. Joe's, and that it was sort of a similar sort of peace and justice umbrella mission, and that those GSA type discussions were encouraged there, but I couldn't get a sense of how that is, whether that's a, you know, continuing with any sort of vigor or not.
And that's what the administrators at Judge also want to see is, I mean, as you mentioned, to redirect Lewis to a peace and justice club where they think that this can be just as easily dealt with, I guess.
Yeah, and so one thing we should note is that Lewis became a little frustrated, and so he went to the internet and started an online petition. And he set the limit on the petition at 1,000, and he was at 1,000 in like 3 days or 4 days, and now it's just a little under 1,200. And I also understand that many people, Judge alumni, people in the current school community with kids currently at school, have reached out to the administrators to have conversations, and they don't seem to be moving the needle at all right now. But I don't think this conversation is going to go away. Lewis tells me he intends to be back in the fall and to keep pushing. Huh.
You know, it seems, I mentioned the previous fight over the GSAs in Utah, the Gay Straight Alliances. It seems like the tenor of these conversations has changed over time and has kind of become less confrontational. This seems like a very sort of polite conversation going on between students and administrators.
I would say it is very polite. And I would say that everyone has everybody's best interests at heart. They don't see eye to eye on what students need. The school is adamant that they have had no other students come to them and say, you know, I feel either excluded or uncomfortable in the same way that Lewis might be expressing, and we need a GSA. At the same time, you have 1,200 people signing a petition from all across the country. You know, some are students, some are past students, some are just supporters. I mean, the country's moved a lot from the time that we had the GSA fight here in Utah. I think there's also now quite a bit of research out there that shows that GSAs have an overwhelmingly positive effect on the overall campus climate. There's one particular study out of a university in Toronto that shows the incidence of campus discrimination of all kinds and the incidence of suicide and attempted suicides among all students, regardless of sexual orientation or gender identity, benefit from having that in that GSA presence and sort of GSA positive type policies.
So he's Lewis is going to continue his petition, try and get a GSA instituted at Judge. You mentioned in your reporting that there were you know, a number of faculty at the school who have rainbow flags on their windows and who are there to support the students.
Yeah, and one of the things administrators told me is that they do a lot of professional development with staff, with counselors, with teachers around issues related to particularly teen suicide. They're working with the Trevor Project, which is a teen suicide project specifically for LGBTQ kids. And so it's not like they're not doing anything, but the type of explicit support that you would get by the GSA presence on a campus is really the type of thing that Lewis is after, that so far they're not willing to go there.
All right. Listeners, we'd love to get your thoughts on this or any of the stories we are covering on the show today. Call us at 801-355-TALK with your questions. We can take them live on air, or you can leave them for us to discuss. You can also comment at sltrib.com or using the hashtag TripTalk on Twitter. Jennifer Dobner, thank you for your great reporting. Listeners, you can find it all at sltrib.com. Okay, Robert Gerke, jumping back to the world of government and politics, Utah lawmakers passed a resolution this last legislative session that called pornography a public health crisis in Utah. And this past week, the crisis came to lawmakers' doorsteps, literally in the form of a special delivery. What happened here?
Well, so some of the lawmakers were none too pleased this week when they went out and got in their mailbox and had received a copy of Hustler magazine from Larry Flint. Back in April, when they passed this and it was signed into law, Larry Flint was pretty explicit that he said he was going to be sending them copies of the magazine to show that it's not a crisis, that the point he was trying to make was that it doesn't pose a danger, and that there have been studies that show it doesn't. Lawmakers also point to studies that show it does present a danger and a risk. And so it showed up in their mailbox. A lot of them, you know, they come wrapped, so I hear. And so a lot of them said they threw it away without opening it. Todd Weiler.
Did they all throw them away? Are we sure?
I haven't actually polled all 104 members. up at the trash of the Capitol building, I'm sure there's, you know, teenagers up there diving through it. So, Senator Weiler said that he thinks that this might rile up his colleagues, and not the way that Larry Flint intended. He thinks it might actually benefit him when he comes back and tries to sponsor additional anti-pornography legislation in the upcoming session that he's working on now.
This is Woods-Cross Senator Todd Weiler.
Yeah.
I imagine that that lawmakers get all kinds of interesting mail, but this has got to be a first, right? Have we seen anything like this in the past?
Well, we believe it's a first for Utah. I haven't heard of it happening before. Larry Flynt, for decades, has been sending copies of Hustler magazine to every member of Congress, every Supreme Court justice, the White House, the vice president.
They also come wrapped, or so I hear.
They also come wrapped, or so.
Yeah, yeah, and so this is not a new stunt or statement, I guess, from Larry Flynt, and he is eccentric, he is outspoken, and will continue to be so. But as to our knowledge, this is the first time he's actually targeted Utah legislators for this sort of to provide them with this sort of service, a gift.
Well, and it's a part of an ongoing effort on his part in the ambit of free speech and what he's doing. How did other lawmakers respond to this? Most just said that they were throwing them away. Did anybody?
Some were upset because while the spokesman for Flint's management group said that they pulled all the addresses for the legislators off the website and assumed that they were sending them to their Capitol building offices or their business address. And in fact, most of the state legislators actually have their home addresses on there. And so there were some who were who were disappointed that they could have fallen into the hands of their children, you know, potentially. I mean, I don't know who opens the mailbox at these members' house, but, you know, it's you know, so there was some frustration with that as well. And you know, I think Representative Jake Andrig said it was classless and Bush League and so, yeah, it upset some folks.
And meanwhile, Todd Weiler has some new legislation he wants to propose at the upcoming session. Did he hint at what that might be?
Well, he had originally talked about requiring cell phone providers or cell phone manufacturers to install filters, pornography filters on their phones. And I think he's kind of backed away from that. He's looking for something that might be a little bit more workable. He's going to spend the next few months talking to tech people, talking to anti-porn advocates, you know, and trying to figure out what's actually doable. But he says he's going to have a bill come January when the legislature meets again to try to at least make it easier for parents to install a filter or have some way to control what their children are seeing on their cell phones and computers.
All right. Well, stay tuned. Sticking with the legislature for a little bit, Robert Gerke, you also reported that some Democratic lawmakers in Utah, or maybe one in particular, have some questions about expenditures by Utah's Commission on Public Lands. That group, of course, is trying to build a lawsuit to sue the federal government for control of public lands in the state. What's going on here? Money not being accounted for? How's this
right
happening?
So the Commission on Stewardship of Public Lands is working on putting together this litigation to take, you know, claim ownership or assert ownership of 30 million acres in the state. The estimated cost is they're talking about on the order of $14 million. What they've done so far is they've hired a Louisiana law firm, the Duvalier Group, to put together a legal analysis of it. And when they got the legal analysis, they voted, okay, well, let's put together a draft complaint, the actual document you would file to initiate the lawsuit. They are nearing completion on that. The chairman of the commission says he expects to have it completed by Wednesday when the legislature meets in interim session. And so they're moving along, and then once the complaint's done, it would be up to Attorney General Sean Reyes and Governor Gary Herbert to kind of decide whether or not to proceed and you know, commit the state to that litigation. Senator Jim DeBacchus, the Democrat, one of the two Democratic members on the commission, is questioning the expenses. They've spent over $900,000 so far on the analysis and the draft complaint. In particular, he's questioning $340,000 that's been spent on relations or public relations these vague terms that are on the invoices. He's wondering what's going on with it. He suggests, he has a suspicion that maybe they're using it to run an opposition PR campaign to the proposed Bears Ears National Monument, but it doesn't necessarily have a lot to back that up. So you know, but he still wants to know, you know, what exactly is it that this commission that is supposed to be working on a legal document is doing with all this money being spent on public relations? Now, the chairman says, the chairman isn't specific about what it's being spent on, but he says once if the complaint is filed, it'll be clear what they spent the money on. He thinks that they are doing it as a means to save money because these PR firms that have been hired are doing work that otherwise would have to be done by the law firm, and the law firm would charge more. So it's actually saving taxpayers money, according to the chairman of the commission. So, but he also wouldn't, you know, turn over invoices or wouldn't describe in any more detail exactly what it is that they're in the process of doing.
Is the chairman the only one who is, you know, able to see these invoices? I with Senator DeBacchus as a member of this commission, he doesn't have access to these.
Well, they provided the invoices. The state paid the invoices. Senator Backus has written a letter to the chairman and to the firms that are providing the service, asking for more information, and he hasn't been told yes or no. Although I guess the fact that the chairman wouldn't, you know, describe right. in any more detail to us what it is, I wonder if he's going to get any more information. Senator Backus previously had asked the commission to kind of to have the lawyers that had been hired to come in and give them a briefing on sort of the weaknesses of the case, because they prepared the legal analysis that said, yes, you know, Utah has a case that they can make here and they could win. But there was also some reference to, you know, adversities that would have to be overcome if the state was going to win. And Senator Backus said, well, you know, let's hear what the weaknesses are if we're going to make a decision on whether to proceed on this. They said that was not something that they were willing to do because they don't want to present a counter argument to their own argument. They would rather let the government come up with that on their own. In a way, I mean, the counter arguments are pretty clear. These are not necessarily new and novel arguments. They've been around for a while, and the arguments on both sides are pretty well established. But Senator DeBacchus was told no to that request, and maybe told no to this one too, it appears.
Dan Harry, if you know, all of these things are tied together, and I'm thinking about the PR campaign. If this were a PR campaign, the $300,000+ that were spent, and it was spent in counter to the proposed Bears Ears National Monument, that's of course a public lands issue, and this commission, or at least I guess the majority of this commission, has its own agenda. You could almost expect the state to be spending some of their money on this. I guess the fact that it's being done secretly is maybe, or without public.
It really raises a question: is what kind of way is this to run a government? I mean, this is public money. This is not the two chairmen's money that they are expending, or money from their campaign supporters. This is public money, and you know, it seems to me a very reasonable request to say, how is this money being spent? And as Robert says, the chairman says, well, if we file this complaint, it will be become very clear what this money's been spent for. But I'm not sure if the draft is going to be made public. Do you know whether their draft complaint will be made?
Yeah, the chairman said that he doesn't expect the draft will be made public because they don't want to, again, tip their hand and put their cards on the table before the attorney general makes a decision one way or another on whether to file. So the anticipation is that on Wednesday he'll go to the Republican caucus. I'm not sure if he'll go to the Democratic caucus or not, but provide his Republican colleagues in caucus an overview of what they've come up with.
And do you think that'll be behind closed doors or not?
It very well could be because of potential for litigation.
Again, so, you know, that just seems to me to raise a whole lot more questions than is called for here. You know, there have been a lot of comments, especially from the biggest vocal supporters of filing this lawsuit, that now is not the time to do it. Mike Noel and mm-hmm. others have said, look, we have a 4-4 split on the Supreme Court. We need to have optimum conditions when we do file this lawsuit because it's going to be a close call.
And expensive.
And now's not the time to do it. Mm-hmm. So the likelihood that all of this information that they're saying, well, just be patient, this will come out, it seems like it could be very well a long way off before the public has any clue of how this money is being spent.
Yeah, the point that Mike Noel made is actually a good one. They want to have a Republican in the White House, and they want to have all of the decisions about their potential for success were predicated on a 5-4 Republican majority on the Supreme Court. And so who that next justice is, whenever there is another justice, if there is another justice, their success or failure could hinge on who that is and what the breakdown is.
And the state says it will have a draft of its lawsuit very soon. When will that be?
Wednesday is when he expects to have the draft complete. As I mentioned, they may or may not release it. It sounds like they probably won't release a copy of the draft complaint. And then it'll go to the Attorney General, and he'll make the decision on whether to commit the state to the litigation.
All right, Robert Gerke. Listeners, you can find more at sltrib.com on this topic. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We're going to have to take a quick break. You can join our conversation by calling us, 801-355-8255. We'll take a short break and return in a moment.
After the White House lifted travel restrictions to Cuba, a lot of filmmakers went down there for the scenery. They found some unusual challenges.
There's just like, there's not hammers and toilet paper and, you know, things that people need.
I'm Kai Rizdal, a Hollywood rush to Cuba. The numbers from Wall Street and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace.
Join us tonight at 6:30 on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater in Logan presents Bach's Mass in B minor. Tuesday, August 2nd, performed by American Festival Chorus, Utah Festival Orchestra, and soloists. Conducted by Dr. Craig Jessup. Details at utahfestival.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm KCPW producer Roger McDonough, joined in studio this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Robert Gerke, Dan Harry, Jennifer Dobner, and via the phone by Thomas Burr, Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent. And we are looking at this past week's news in review. Again, you are encouraged to join us. Call us at 801-355-TALK or post a comment at sltrib.com. We're running low on time, and we'll have to go to our underplayed stories of the week soon, but a final politics story from this past week. Jonathan Johnson picks up another big check from the CEO of Overstock.com. Robert Gerke, how much did Byrne give this time?
Well, he gave another $250,000 to the Johnson campaign. Johnson is the chairman of the board of Overstock. You know, Patrick Byrne is the CEO. They've worked together for 14 years. The $250,000 contribution, it brings the total that he's given to the campaign to $850,000, which is by far the largest single contribution to a political candidate that we've seen. And you know, obviously the Herbert campaign is raising questions about this. You know, what is Patrick Byrne expecting in return? They're almost portraying it as, you know, Jonathan Johnson is Patrick Byrne's puppet, and Patrick is trying to buy the office for him. Both Byrne and Johnson say that we agree on things, we disagree on things, we're good friends. Patrick said that he thinks that Jonathan would be a good governor, and that's why he's supporting him, and he's not expecting anything in return. The $850,000 is about 60% of the money that Jonathan's raised. You add in $200,000 that Jonathan gave to his campaign and $200,000 from another person related to, you know, who's tied to Overstock, and you get up to about almost, you know, 85 and almost 90%, I think, of the money for his campaign has come from those three sources.
Well, they have a long-standing business relationship as well, Jonathan Johnson and Patrick Byrne, having worked together at
Overstock. 14 years working together. Patrick has been active in a lot of issues. He's a controversial figure both in business world and in the political world. You know, he and his family poured something like $4 million into the school voucher movement. Overstock and Patrick were supporters of the fight to overturn Utah's ban on same-sex marriage, and so he's been involved in politics for a long time. He's one of the people who's backing a push to legalize marijuana in the state, which is something that Jonathan Johnson has said he also supports, actually. He's a controversial figure. He's given a ton of money, and the questions are being raised about. And this all happens in the context of the fundraising issue being sort of the forefront of this gubernatorial campaign since the get-go because of what comments that Governor Herbert made about how he's willing to go anywhere and meet with anyone.
Available Jones.
The Available Jones comments. So, it's sort of taken center stage. And it comes as at a time when ballots are in the mail and people have, you know, are starting to vote. The primary is not till June 28th, but the mail-in voting's already begun. So, you know, these are the things that actually can start having an impact on how those votes are cast.
This will be decided soon. By comparison, how is Governor Herbert's fundraising campaign going? How is he doing compared to the massive checks that that Jonathan Johnson is picking up from Byrne?
Yeah, that's a good question. Now Governor Herbert's never been a slouch at fundraising either. In that meeting with the lobbyists, he said he wanted to raise $1 million by June 1st. I'm not sure we haven't seen the report, so we don't know if he actually hit that threshold. He consistently raises about $1.7-1.8 million a campaign. He gets checks for anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 to $25,000. I think in some instances, I think Gail Miller has given him something like $50,000 or $75,000. So he's brought in some big money too. But then you put that in context, it's the $850,000 is orders of magnitude more than the largest contribution that Governor Herbert's got. But again, as an incumbent governor, the money sort of flows to you anyway. There's not nearly as much effort that has to come. And Jonathan Johnson has said that that Governor Herbert and his team have shut down other fundraising avenues for them because people who are otherwise supporters who might want to give him money are afraid to, because they're afraid that they'll lose influence or the governor's office, the door to the governor's office will be slammed shut on him.
Hmm. Well, so primary election, as you said, later this month, and then it's on to November's general election, where the winner in the Republican Party is will be facing Michael Weinholz.
Michael Weinholz, a Democrat who has given his own campaign over $1 million. So, no shortage of money flowing there either.
Well, on the fundraising topic as well, we have a big fundraiser in town right now. That is Mitt Romney, who is coming, or maybe who I think is here already, for his annual E2 summit, which begins this week. Next week, as a matter of fact. Dan Harry, what is this summit all about?
It did start last night with the introductory comments from Mitt Romney. Goes through Saturday morning. This is an annual kind of get-together and think big thoughts conference that Mitt Romney has started. And a lot of it's been involved in politics. Last year, for instance, Robert covered for us that there was a parade of presidential candidates trooping through, and they were sort of, as he described it in his reporting, auditioning in front of fundraisers and bundlers, because that's a very important element of a presidential campaign. And I think if I remember correctly, Chris Christie was the big hit of some of the bundlers that time.
So. Yeah, Chris Christie made an impression. Scott Walker was there. Carly Fiorina made a little bit of a name for herself just because she was sort of unknown. Lindsey Graham was there. John Kasich was there. I mean, you had most. Marco Rubio was there.
Donald Trump was not.
Donald Trump was not there, and I think that was, you can read into that what you will, but I think given Mitt Romney's comments in the recent months and his efforts to try to recruit a third, another candidate, I think that sort of speaks to the reason Donald wasn't there and isn't there this time, and I think you can probably anticipate that there will be some anti-Donald rhetoric up there this time as well.
Is there any, just speaking of Mitt Romney, is there any sense that at the upcoming Republican National Convention there might be still a contested convention where somebody else might try and come forward?
I think it's the way the rules are stacked at this point. I don't think it's plausible. I think they've kind of, in terms of trying to mount a challenge, and maybe Tommy's still on the line, he can speak to this as well. But I think the way the rules are written for the convention, it's going to be incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to bring somebody else out of nowhere to try to challenge him. I don't think there's an appetite for it necessarily to create that kind of chaos.
Thomas Byrd, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, Robert's absolutely correct. I mean, the idea of trying to overturn right now at the convention would tick off, even if it's possible, would tick off so many people in the base and also create that party split that they're really trying to fix right now. So it's just it's a horrible idea in some ways for the party.
And trying to mount a third party challenge at this point, getting on the ballot in enough states to actually make a difference is almost impossible as well. So that ship has kind of sailed.
Well, lots of great political reporting at sltrip.com this election year, and again, just five more months of this left. And it's time now for our final segment of the week. Our final segment, the underplayed story of the week, a chance to weigh in on what's caught our interest but maybe hasn't seen a lot of coverage in the news. And I don't know if you guys are prepared, but Robert Gerke, do you have an underplayed story?
Well, I'm not going to go with an underplayed story. I'm going to tease something that's coming up. I think we're getting new poll numbers this year, later today, looking at some of the dynamics of the 2016 election, and I think readers will be very interested in finding out what we've learned.
Worth checking out. Okay, so new polling numbers coming out, and stay tuned for that. Jennifer Doudna, an underplayed story of the week?
I don't know if it's underplayed, but Weldon Angelos was released from federal prison this week. He's a Utah music producer who was sent to prison in 2004, I believe, on drugs and weapons charges. Minimum mandatory sentence, 55 years. The federal judge at the time, Paul Cassell, who's now at University of Utah, law professor, reluctantly sentenced him, and Angelos has been sort of one of the poster children for the fight against minimum mandatories. He was released, I think we found out about it on Monday, and the details of why he got out early are unclear. The records are sealed. So be interesting to see.
Could it have been a presidential pardon?
No, he was not pardoned. It was not a commutation. Released those lists publicly, and his name was notably absent from it.
Okay.
So it'll be interesting to see like what he does next and if he sort of jumps into the politics of minimum mandatories. But that was a really interesting development.
And that's one of the intriguing things of this is it was done very secretly. Mm. The prosecutor made a motion for this to happen, and then they've immediately sealed it.
Wow.
So our reporter has filed an FOI, Freedom of Information, to try to get at that, to look at the documents behind it.
And we should say that this is one of the cases that sort of pushed Cassell off the bench.
Right. Well, it's a definitely interesting story, and you can check it out at sltrip.com as well. Dan Harry, an underplayed story of the week by
chance. Very quickly, the Mormon Church can relax. The new convention hotel at the Salt Palace will not be taller than their building, nor the Wells Fargo building, which claims the same tallest building in the city.
All right, new convention hotel. Thomas Burr, how about yourself?
Also teasing something upcoming. There are very few people Muhammad Ali wanted to speak at his funeral, and this afternoon one of those is Senator Orrin Hatch. And I was reading a little bit of preview of his speech, and it's pretty powerful. So this afternoon, Muhammad Ali's funeral in Louisville, we have Senator Orrin Hatch speaking on his behalf.
That was going to be mine as well, and also Paul Raleigh's story on the unusual friendship between the champ and Senator Orrin Hatch. And it is great stuff. Also available.
They're both the greatest, for the record.
Well, a quick note that we normally wrap up with a segment by Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. We'll get back to that next week. But that is it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW Radio, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Bennett Purser at Utah Public Radio, and Emily Means, who is with both the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Many thanks to Robert Gerke, Jennifer Doudna, Dan Harry, and Thomas Burr for joining us on the program this week. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks, everybody, for joining us as well. Have a great weekend.
What's wrong with hitting somebody, anyway?
This week on Radiolab.
Because the skin can get cut.
We wonder about right and wrong.
What is morality?
How do people make this judgment?
Is there a right? Is there a wrong?
When does it start?
Children really are beginning to develop a moral sense in the second year of life.
And where does it come from?
What we might call the inner chimp.
Ten Commandments, for God's inner chimp.
The Science of Morality, this week on Radiolab.
Join us this Saturday at noon on Utah Public Radio.
Next time on Ask Me Another, the hosts of the hit podcast Invisibilia, Lulu Miller and Elise Spiegel, have a hard time with failure.
That is incorrect.
Are you kidding me? That is so correct. That is so correct.
Join me, Jonathan Colton, on Ask Me Another, NPR's hour of puzzles, word games, and trivia.
Join us Saturday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Hey, what's up? I'm Shad. Love is a skill.
That's the belief put forth in the new novel from Alain de Botton. Next time on Q, the essayist and philosopher will join me to talk about love in the long term. Plus, we'll have live music from the rootsy Victoria, BC musician Northcote. That is all coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International. Today at 1, right here on Utah Public Radio.
Utah Public Radio is a statewide service of the College of Humanities and Social Science. The time now is 10 o'clock.